Medicon Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicon Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Childs. I'm the host of this podcast, and I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to today's podcast covering the American College of Cardiology's Scientific Sessions and Expo from April 6th through 8th, 2024 in Atlanta, Georgia. Over 17,000 cardiovascular professionals from around the globe came together to debate and discuss practice-changing science and innovations. Today, I was able to interview two of the late-breaking trialists. Firstly, we speak with Professor Greg Stone, MD, a professor of cardiology and population health sciences at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York, who opened the late-breaking session by presenting the findings from RELIEVE-HF trial, a randomized trial designed to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of treating heart failure patients with an interatrial shunt. Professor Stone and colleagues randomized more than 500 patients to either receive the V-Wave Ventura intraatrial shunt system, a small device designed to reduce pressure in the left atrium and the lungs, or undergo a placebo procedure. The results are really clear, and keep listening to find out more and hear Professor Stone's interpretation of these exciting results. Next, we speak with Professor Javed Butler, MD, president of the Baylor Scott & White Research Institute, who presented results from the IMPACT-MI randomized trial, which examined treating patients with empagliflozin following heart attack. Treatment with empagliflozin did not significantly impact the study's primary endpoint, the combination of heart failure hospitalizations and all-cause mortality, but it did appear to dramatically improve heart failure hospitalization rates when tracked on their own. These results add to our understanding of SGLT2 inhibitors and how they contribute to the body of evidence across six clinical studies examining the potential for empagliflozin to impact major outcomes in a broad population of adults with heart failure, chronic kidney disease, or type 2 diabetes. Enjoy listening. We start out speaking with Professor Greg Stone about the RELIEVE-HF trial. So again, thank you so much. So I wanted to ask you about the RELIEVE-HF in particular. If you could tell me just what was the primary conclusion from this trial?
Right. Well, the primary conclusion was that placement of the Ventura intraatrial shunt device in a very sick heart failure population was very safe, but in the overall population did not show a signal for effectiveness across the spectrum of left ventricular ejection fractions. But we saw a markedly disparate or discordant treatment effect in patients with reduced versus preserved ejection fraction, such that in those with left ventricular ejection fraction at baseline of less than or equal to 40%, there was a marked benefit, nearly a 50% reduction in adverse cardiovascular events, in particular heart failure hospitalizations, but also directional reductions in all-cause death, LVAD, and transplant. Whereas in patients with preserved left ventricular ejection fraction greater than 40%, we saw clear evidence of harm, in particular increased heart failure hospitalizations, but also a tripling of mortality. So I believe that, again, in a very sick patient population with a lot of heart failure symptoms, despite excellent medical background therapy, that there is a real future for intraatrial shunts in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction, whereas their use would have to be extremely carefully considered if used at all in patients with preserved ejection fraction.
Right. So my first question was, what do these findings actually suggest about the pathophysiological circumstances differentiating between HFpEF and FREF? Do you have any clues?
Yeah, we do. And I didn't have time to present the data, but I did speak about it. And we have baseline transthoracic echocardiographic data and 1 year echocardiographic data. What the two conditions share is increased left atrial pressure. And the left atrial pressures at baseline were about a median of 16 millimeters of mercury. And many of the parameters were similar, but they are very different in terms of the size of the left ventricle, okay, the size of all the cardiac structures. In HFrEF, the heart is very dilated. The left ventricle in particular is very weak. And the heart is very compliant. For that 16 millimeters of mercury, you've got a very dilated left ventricle. Whereas in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, the left ventricle sizes are normal. Right. The right ventricle size is normal. And the heart is very, very stiff or very non-compliant. And so what we saw was that in HFrEF, the heart was able to accommodate the increased blood flow from the left atrium to the right atrium. We did not see change in right ventricular dimensions. We didn't see an increase in tricuspid regurgitation or the diameter of the inferior vena cava. The pulmonary artery pressures did not go up. The cardiac output did not go down. The only thing that changed was the left ventricles got a little smaller. So the left atrial pressure goes down, the left ventricles get smaller, there's less pulmonary venous congestion, and the patients get better. In contrast, in the patients with stiff hearts, with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, there's nowhere for that extra fluid to go because the hearts are non-compliant. So that did have an effect on increasing the inferior vena cava dimensions. It increased tricuspid regurgitation. It actually did somewhat increase RV dimensions. It increased pulmonary artery pressure substantially, and pulmonary artery pressure is a strong determinant of mortality. And the cardiac output decreased, most likely because the septum shifted more from the right ventricle into the left ventricle, impeding filling of the left ventricle, although we didn't measure that directly. So as a result, basically, even though they share some of the increased left atrial pressure at baseline, the structure of the heart's not able to accommodate the increased blood flow from left to right in HFpEF, where it was able to in HFrEF.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, right? So how would this change your view on patient selection going forward? And we've got some future trials coming up, right? There's, I think, LA-HF and Responder-HF.
Well, I mean, certainly based on our data, I would focus on HFrEF.
Yeah.
If you just look at the baseline clinical event rates in HFrEF and HFpEF in our study, even though these were both sick patient populations, there was an 89% per year event rate in the HFrEF patients in the control arm and a 36% per year event rate in the HFpEF patients. So HFrEF is still the clinical need, despite the fact that these patients were on average on more than three of the four class one indicated HFrEF directed medications. But LA-HF and Responder, the Corvea Responder trial, are enrolling a very different HFpEF population, a much lower risk HFpEF population than we enrolled. And if you look just at the original reduced LAP-HF2 trial, their patients had almost no mortality, which was surprising in a heart failure population, control population. So they chose patients who were basically doing well. They were low risk patients, but they had some symptoms. And they had to have exercise-induced increased pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. That's how they got into that trial. And the overall trial was negative, but they were able to find, again, a subgroup of two-thirds or so of the patients of this very low-risk cohort that was even lower risk, that had even lower natriuretic peptide levels, even better lack of right heart involvement, if you will, even lower pulmonary vascular resistance, lower pulmonary artery pressures that may respond to a shunt. So there may be a sweet spot in a small proportion of patients with HFpEF where you're not going to reduce their mortality because they're having almost no mortality. And I think their heart failure hospitalization rates are pretty low. So maybe you can improve quality of life, but we'll have to see what the trials show because we saw this placebo effect in quality of life measures, as did Corvea in their trial. So to me, the sweet spot clearly that came out of this trial was the heart failure with reduced ejection fraction patients who still need a lot of help, who we saw that a shunt, we only randomized 206 of those patients, and there was still a marked reduction in benefit such that we still had a p-value of less than 0.0001.
So given the fact that the safety was relatively encouraging and there was a nuanced, efficacy, how do you envision the discussions with your patients of the risk-benefit ratios going forward?
Well, right now, this is an investigational device. So obviously, I don't have to worry about that discussion yet. So it'll all depend on whether or not FDA deems this data set sufficient to approve the device for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, patients who are refractory on current guideline-directed medical therapy. In which case, then I think we'll be able to talk just directly about what the randomized data showed within the RELIEVE-HF trial among patients with HFrEF.
Right. And do you think any post-hoc analysis that might still be going on will reveal a quality of life difference in a certain subpopulation?
Well, potentially, because, you know, in every randomized trial, whether positive, negative, or neutral, there's usually some patients who benefit, some patients who have neutral effects, and other patients that are harmed. And we haven't done a responder analysis yet within the HFrEF population to determine which patients in particular might have responded or not responded. Right. Nor have we done that in the HFpEF population. So I think that's very important data that's yet to come. But I do think that this really opens the door because it shows that there's potential tremendous benefit in patients with a great ongoing clinical need in heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. I would expect to see a whole slate of new clinical trials of a variety of different types of interatrial shunts. Of the one that we tested, of course, was a very specific design with a very specific orifice diameter and shunt flow rate. There are many other types of designs that are out there. And now that we've kind of identified what I think is the sweet spot of the patient population that can really benefit, I expect to see a lot more clinical trial activity, and we're going to learn a lot more in the
Terrific.
Next 5 years.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being with me.
Next, I speak with Professor Javed Butler about the IMPACT MI trial that was presented immediately following Professor Stone, as would happen. I would really like your interpretation of these rather surprising results of having no impact on overall survival versus hospitalization for heart failure. Could you talk a little bit about how we're supposed to understand these data?
Yeah, so these data are actually, to me, pretty clear. There were some sort of risks taken and they didn't necessarily pan out. So let me sort of go into a little bit more detail, sort of through the machinery of how the trial was designed, and that can probably
perfect things. Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of pressure to decrease the cost and the burden of the trials on the patients and on the sites. And there's a lot of interest in doing pragmatic clinical trials, which make sense. As part of the pragmatic clinical trial, a few decisions that we made in this trial, one was that our inclusion-exclusion criteria were very general, so you didn't have to do any special test to qualify. We collected data, which was pretty narrow and relatively streamlined and didn't have reams and reams of CRFs where data were collected that most of the time we never even looked. We actually had only one in-person visit. There were no follow-up lab tests. There was no, you know, exams or this, that, the other. Everything was remote in that trial follow-up. But the fourth thing is probably the most relevant to your question about not seeing mortality benefit. So the fourth issue was that most of the trials, part of the cost and the delays and whatnot occurs to something which is called a clinical events committee. Clinical events committee is where, you know, a bunch of experts are given all the documents from the site, and then they review and they decide whether this person died of this reason or that reason and this, that, the other. Now, if you look at what the doctors at the site are saying, who are not trained adjudicators, but they are just clinicians, the patient is right in front of them. So obviously, there's 100% correlation whether the person is alive or not. So that's simple. But the two places where the correlation is not very good. So if you look at if a doctor says it's a heart failure hospitalization and then the experts review, there's a 90%+ chance that both will agree. Very, very good correlation. The two places where there's not a very good correlation is one is the cause of death, and then the second is outpatient heart failure. So there is a lot of pressure to reduce heart failure admissions and whatnot, and people are being sort of trained to treat and diagnose and treat patients in the outpatient heart failure setting. Because we did not have a central adjudication committee as part of a streamlined trial, we went for all-cause mortality, not cardiovascular mortality, as a component of the primary endpoint. And if you look at all big trials in cardiovascular space, cardiovascular mortality is the primary endpoint, not all-cause right. mortality. So suppose, you know, if you have, you know, 100 people that die post-MI, you know, you can expect about 75, 80 of them will die of cardiovascular causes. But right at the top, 20-25% will not die of cardiovascular causes, and there's no chance that SGLT2 inhibitors will improve their outcome, right? So there's a little bit of a noise built in there. So that's one issue. The second issue is that early post myocardial infarction mortality, a lot of crap happens that SGLT2 inhibitors can do anything, ventricular septal ruptures and recurrent MIs and stent thrombosis or whatever. So if you put these two things together, by the time you develop heart failure and that heart failure then translates into either arrhythmic or pump failure mortality, it takes some time, right?
Right.
So that was one problem.
Yeah, the follow-up is only 18 months.
But worse, follow-up after heart failure development was shy of a year, was not even
right.
A year. Okay, so that's one. So that's one component, mortality component. Now, the second component is heart failure. So we took the risk, calculated risk, that we are going to let go of, say, 10-15% of the heart failure burden in the outpatient setting by the study design. Except that when we were designing the trial, we could not predict that there would be such a thing as COVID-19. So then the pandemic happened. So the first 2 years of the trial was solid in the middle of pandemic. And the problem with that is that there is now plenty of literature out there that the hospitalization rates plummeted during the COVID pandemic. So now we are really worried that 10-15% in the ideal case would be the outpatient heart failure missing, but now maybe it's a bigger proportion. And then on top of that, the two regions that were very active in the trial, Israel and Ukraine, Russia, both, all of them were in wars. So now again, the heart failure hospitalization and the patterns or whatever. So it is what it is. But it affects the results in two ways. One is that, of course, you don't have heart failure outpatient diagnosis in the endpoint, but it also changes the ratio in the primary endpoint. So if I were to just ask you in the beginning of the trial, if 100 people were to be in your endpoint of all-cause mortality and heart failure endpoint, give me a ratio. So you would say, well, you know, 40 will be deaths and 60 will be hospitalizations, right? Here we had the reverse. We had more deaths than heart failure hospitalizations. Like, how can that be, right? There is systematic undercalculation of heart failure hospitalization. At the end of the day, we live in a p-value-oriented world. It is what it is. These are all sort of explanations to understand the results of the study, but the p-value was not reached. But if we look at the heart failure results, that is identical to what we have seen in diabetes, in CKD, in HFrEF, in HFpEF. So not an effect on mortality. 23% reduction in heart failure time to first event, 33% reduction in total heart failure events. And interestingly enough, although not part of primary endpoint and it's exploratory analysis, if you do include outpatient heart failure in the endpoint, even all-cause mortality and heart failure hospitalization total is positive, and the heart failure signal is 23% relative risk reduction time to first, 33% total, and 37% for inpatient and outpatient combined.
So sounds like there isn't a signal. It sounds like there's a signal, but it's you can't draw that hard conclusion based on the trial design.
Absolutely. So let me just quickly give you one more result. So we wanted to really pressure test this outpatient test. So what we did is we said, well, if you are not on heart failure therapy at the time of discharge and post-discharge you were started on heart failure therapies, that's a surrogate marker that you're developing outpatient heart failure. And ARNI use, any RAS inhibitor use, MRA use, and diuretic use post-discharge were all much more common in the placebo arm than the treatment arm. So if you're a strict frequentist, then you would say that the trial is negative. If you're a Bayesian, you would say that the totality of evidence suggests that you significantly reduce the risk of heart failure development post-acute myocardial infarction.
So if you're looking at the comprehensive heart failure burden, basically.
Yeah.
And my other question was, what about real-world data? Can we rely on that to support some of these conclusions? Can we take this as hypothesis going forward? Because this trial is over, is that correct?
Yes, the trial is over. I mean, I think different people have different perspectives on heart failure hospitalization. I tend to believe in real-world data a lot when it comes to safety. I do get a little bit concerned about the efficacy data because there is clearly a bias of indication why people get and not get the data. Having said that, so far, all real-world evidence data that has been published support heart failure risk reduction with SGLT2 inhibitor in real world, very similar to clinical trials.
What about STEMI versus NSTEMI and non-STEMI? Do you have anything to say about that? Because I think that that might give some insight.
This is unbelievably important question that you have mentioned. So 100 years ago, when I was a resident in training, patients with non-STEMI had a lower risk and patients with STEMI had a higher risk. Angioplasty was not completely common. Thrombolytic therapy, some people got it early, some people got it late, et cetera, et cetera. That whole world has changed. Now, STEMI patients have excellent prognosis because you come in, you get revascularized, you're done, right? So non-STEMI have a higher risk. If you look at the real world data, non-STEMI to STEMI ratio is 3:1. 75% of the MIs are non-STEMI high-risk patients, and 1/4 is STEMI. When we do clinical trial, we saw that in Paradise MI, we saw this in MPACT MI, it reverses exactly the opposite. Most of the patients are lower risk STEMI patients with fewer non-STEMI patients. So again, if you were to put the eye of faith in it, all secondary analysis, I concede that the STEMI patients had about a 40%, 30% lower risk. So the annualized event risk in STEMI patients was about 8%, and the non-STEMI patient was about 12% in the placebo arm. So it's non-STEMI patient had a higher risk. And the benefit was higher, about the point estimate was 0.77 in non-STEMI patients. So I think that that non-STEMI patient is really enriched population for benefit early use of SGLT2 inhibitors.
That's actually a very interesting conclusion. So are there any final messages you want to give to fellow physicians about how to understand this data or how they should treat SGLT2 inhibitors in general in this setting?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is that unbelievably good safety signal.
Yes.
Total adverse event leading to discontinuation, contrast-induced nephropathy, AKI, none of them were signals or any different between the two arms. So I would say, the way I look at this, if somebody comes in with acute myocardial infarction and they already have indication for SGLT2 inhibitor, in an ideal world, they would already be on an SGLT2 inhibitor. But suppose they come in, they are not on. So if you have heart failure, if you have diabetes, if you have CKD, physicians should feel very comfortable starting it during admission because of the safety impact. Now, suppose if you have an acute myocardial infarction patient who has none of the other indications, they don't have heart failure, they don't have diabetes, they don't have CKD. If that patient has non-STEMI, I would be very much inclined in starting early.
Okay.
If they come in with a STEMI and they get revascularized, I would watch that patient for a few days. If their LV is still depressed, if they're still congested, I would start an SGLT2 inhibitor. If their stunned myocardium reverses, their EF is totally normalized and they are feeling great, then maybe it's okay to watch that patient.
Those are excellent advice. So thank you so much for your time and insights. Really appreciated.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.